Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Zero to Exit, where we share insights from the industry leaders on how to build and sell great tech products and companies. This is Nilima and Ankur, your hosts. In today's show, we are going to talk about all things product, company culture, startups with Rishi Bhargava. Rishi is the co-founder of Demisto, a security orchestration and response product company that was acquired by Palo Alto Networks in March 2019. He has launched multiple products in his career in risk and compliance, virtualization, and cloud security space. He is also a technology enthusiast, a serial patent holder, and one unique thing about him, he can take any product role and completely own it. He's currently doing product strategy for Palo Alto Networks. In Demisto, he led the product marketing function, and prior to that, product management roles at Intel Security. Last but not the least, I can tell the audience from my personal experience, is a lot of fun to work with. Hi Rishi, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here and very excited to talk about some exciting stuff.
Before we get into the meat of the discussion, what are some of the latest technology trends you are following currently?
That's an interesting one. I am actually a gadget freak, buying everything. But from a technology trend these days, I am following a lot of the innovations happening, no surprise, on machine learning and AI, but applied to what I call kind of daily things that we have humans have done. For example, these days, particularly, I'm following what are people doing with machine learning AI on music side, music creation, detecting music, finding fake music or copied music, and things like those. I'm a true believer. I think some of the innovations in AI are going to truly change how we live our life. And kind of in that theme with music, the other one is augmented reality, where I'm a fundamental believer in 2 years, how we buy stuff will be completely different.
On the subject of AI and ML, I was recently reading something that Mark Andreessen said. You know, he said one of the two ways the AML technology can kind of take off. One is that it becomes a feature in just about every tech product that we see, which is kind of what we see nowadays anyways. But the second is that AIML becomes kind of the platform, kind of the founding construct on which the applications will have to be rebuilt. And what he's saying is that that's going to start just like internet and 2.0. It's going to start a new wave of applications where you're going to have to build applications from scratch with AIML as a platform. Do you subscribe to any of the point of views?
Yeah, I think maybe not a binary answer, Ankur. What's going to happen is for some applications which already exist out there, it'll go with the path where it becomes a feature across the applications. But the new applications that are going to be developed, they'll be starting with assuming certain things in AI and ML exist. I'll take an example, right? When I was studying engineering 20 years ago, compilers were in the same mode, right? Lots of innovation happening on compiler. The hardware level was being innovated. And the fundamental thing was we used to study every minute aspects of compilers. Today, you don't. You assume that you're going to write your code. It's going to run on all kind of hardware and be optimized for that hardware. We don't know what's happening inside the compiler. AI ML are going to that phase where I believe if you start a company now, you don't need to understand how does AI work, ML work. There are a set of algorithms that are available as a platform, set of strategies available. You hire a person who's reasonably familiar, not even deep understanding, and you try one of those five things and you innovate on top. Like, it is going to become that easy, that available, just like a compiler, where you don't need to be an expert in AI and ML. You just assume that you can use that in your application.
Got it. Speaking of new founders wanting to start a lot of AI and ML startups, and we're seeing is a whole bunch of them coming up. When did you figure out that it's time to start a company? Was that an inflection point?
Yes. So I think the story of Demisto wanting to start a company is team first, idea later. We wanted to do something was more of a mindset. All the four founders were at McAfee, and we were like, okay, we need to go build something. There's a lot of options. We don't know exactly what we want, but we wanted to go work together as a team. We found each other company really enjoyable. We debate hard, and then we all agree and commit or disagree and commit, but we commit. I have some fond memories of our first attempt to go pitch to VCs, and one of the VC meetings we got was in London. We all flew to London, early days of Airbnb. Back then, Airbnb was not popular. We got a room and spent a couple of days in a room debating on the idea, topic, coming up with a few ideas and pitching. I think it all started by saying, we need to do something together. And to be honest, it was a good year and a half before we started Demisto after we said we're going to do something. We brainstormed on ideas. We thought about doing some other work, got in way of leaving and starting. But that's how it came about.
And were you, we were talking to Lee Clerick, you know, chief product officer, kind of instrumental in Palo Alto success. He talked about kind of blue ocean, red ocean strategy. Your background, Rishi, is endpoint security, and you could have gone into a kind of red ocean, but instead you went after blue ocean. Were there a lot of debates on that subject as well? What market to go after?
No, we did not have debate on red ocean or blue ocean. What was very clear to us was the idea needed to excite us. And the more I think about it, it's more about, can we do something significant with an idea and does it excite us? Interestingly, I would claim that most of the founders, the beginning of the idea is always with red ocean. In fact, our first idea when we started was exactly is like, let's go redo the endpoint security with some cool innovations. And after a good 30 to 40 customer conversations, we very quickly realized is it's another crowded space. It's going to be a bloodbath. We can go re-innovate that, but it was not fun. So we quickly changed our question to what is the number one problem that nobody else is solving and how can we solve that? And that is the question we started asking people rather than pitching them our idea.
Yeah, really interesting. I think a lot of the founders start with that story. They see a problem themselves. They get super excited and passionate about it. And then they start something in a domain where they personally see a problem, right? I mean, startups are hard. And unless you are truly excited about the thing that you're trying to do, I think it's just really not going to click well.
Definitely. And I think that's exactly what happened. And I think we got excited about security orchestration. Well, it was not called that back then, problem domain. It has changed its name. And then I think in that journey, we were seeing elements of cool stuff done in IT and Slack was coming up. So we wanted to do something on collaboration front. So it's basically evolved as we had customer discussion.
How did the pivot from the endpoint to the orchestration pieces come in? What were the threads that kind of led to that idea?
Yeah, I think that's actually a very, very interesting question. I did went back and analyzed. So the pivot happened over 29 different slide versions. So the endpoint idea, which was very clear, is everybody in 2015 was talking about endpoint detection and response because prevention is not working. We have tried prevention. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when you will be breached. So let's move to more response and detection rather than prevention. So the first thought process was, let's go figure out something in detection and response. And there were some good companies, Carbon Black, Tanium, doing some amazing stuff. Silence was in early days. CrowdStrike was in early days. But we latched on to, we're going to do something in detection and response was very clear. The second thing, we meaning the founding team, was using Slack, our private team that we had created, to exchange ideas, right? So where would we write thoughts and blog that we read or an article that we read? We were using Slack, and we were using Slack very heavily for our internal brainstorming. So those were two elements, which is we need to do something in detection and response, and we were using Slack and brainstorming. So first part of that micro pivot, I would call, for our idea was, okay, wouldn't it be amazing if people use Slack to collaborate and find where the problem is from a security response perspective? Can they use Slack to respond to things? Can they archive all of these? We want to use Slack for collaborating and solve a problem in security. So we researched, and right about then, the word ChatOps was being born. And we said, okay, we're going to do ChatOps in security. That was one thing. Second thing in the pivot was what's happening is, if it is detection and response, why only endpoint? Products are not talking to each other. There is no connectivity layer among security products. So we said, okay, why only a endpoint? Can't we expand to talk to every product and focus on detection and response? So between those two was the idea of Demisto born, which is, can we connect to all the tools and can we use collaboration for solving security problems? And the third pillar, which is the whole workflow, was an expansion after looking at the market. Who else is doing this? Who else is messaging this? And in the early versions, people were talking Phantom, Resilient System was being acquired by IBM right around then. And then we said, basically, there is automation workflow that is being built. Detection and response is the use case, and collaboration is a key thing. That's how these things came together.
Yeah, fascinating. I was part of some of those interviews, so I remember some of the questions that were being asked, me coming from endpoint background. So pivoting to your team first comment, finding a new company, there's so many unknowns. What should you consider when choosing your co-founders? What are some of the key things to keep in mind?
Yeah, I am a big believer in life where I use this whenever I meet people, it's attitude before aptitude. So, and then the skills, like literally I would put people says, hey, do they have the right attitude? Are they smart? And third comes the skills in that order for me, right? And it's not just co-founders. If I look at how we hired, if I look at how we engaged with our advisors, it's always been that philosophy, which is like, does this person have a positive attitude? Can they go in and solve a problem? And there's some from my early mentors, I would put Rosen Sharma as one of them. We had hired one person. I was like, why did you hire him? He's like a fresh grad, is not even done an engineering degree. And his response was, I liked his hairdo. I was like, hairdo, what do you mean? It's like, I don't know. I just, when I met this person, it was a good conversation and I liked the person. And I think that hairdo to me was the attitude. And I think for co-founders, the same thing. Can you spend 16 hours a day back to back for the next 5 to 7 years with them or not? So my first advice is go with somebody who you know, who you have worked with, either socially know, worked with, either which way, because it's a very hard thing to answer. If you spend somebody 3 months with somebody, you say, oh, can I spend 16 hours a day, 7 years with them? You don't know that answer. But if you spend 4 years with them, which was the case with us, I knew the answer. I can spend more time with these co-founders. But then when you don't have that luxury of finding people you have worked with, I think I would still go with that order if I were to pick. I was helping a friend answer the same question and he asked me, he's like, hey, this person I like, he's a very good friend. I've spent enough time, but he has the same skills as me. And my answer to him was, so what? That means you need to reinvent yourself. Let him run with that piece. You will have a mind meld where if you want to do something, you just tell them very quickly, go run on this and you take care of other part of the business. You need to find other people to complement your skills, but I truly believe skills could be built and learned. Attitudes cannot be changed easily.
Yeah. In today's political climate, it's hard to agree on anything. How did you guys get to agree on anything, being that there were like 4 co-founders?
We're going to ignore the political comment here, given where we are. I remember the board dinner after we signed all of the Palo Alto sale papers and 4 of us were sitting post-dinner. We look back. It's not that we agreed. I think it's the fact that we trusted each other. So even when we disagreed, and we still disagree, whoever has a very, very strong point of view and wants to run with it, we let the person run with it because we trust that whatever they're doing for the best interest of the company, right? So whenever there were points of discussion, I think we presented facts which did not involve ego, and it's like, okay, I was wrong. And there's if you see our team, people make fun of any one of us, right? I mean, there's internal jokes and people will call out Slavik that you made this mistake, you made that mistake. They'll call out each one of us And that's perfectly fine. I think we made enough mistakes and we learned from those. We don't worry about our ego. And that's what was the Cree, right? No ego and amazing amount of trust. And I think that trust is, to me, what took us forward across the board, where the decisions, like, I had never done marketing. I had never done sales. When we hired our head of sales, we made a mistake. And then it's like, okay, we made a mistake on the first head of sales. Move on. Let's go figure out the next one. And similarly, we made a product's mistakes early on. I mean, we quickly pivoted. It's like, okay, bad call. Switch and fix.
A follow-up on that one. You said you started in 2015 and the idea was cooking for 1.5 years. So when you went to raise the seed, was the prototype already there?
So I'll rephrase. The idea was not cooking for 1.5 years. So I think we went through probably 4 or 5 different ideas in that 1.5 years, all at a discussion stage. So when we went for funding, there was, I wouldn't call it a prototype. I would say it's a front-end demo that Slavik worked on. So it left McAfee way earlier than all 4 of us. And it goes to that trust thing. There's like, said, okay, guys, we are all in. Yes, we had different milestones when we were going to leave McAfee, personal decisions, personal reasons. But with that trust, Slavik says, I'm going to jump in first. And he started to work on a prototype. But the idea evolved between March and July. So what we really had was a demo and an outline of what the user flow would look like. In fact, this is my advice. What's more important to raise money early on is not really a prototype, because I would say if you have the background and pedigree, people would believe that you can build an enterprise product. But what is more important is to build the workflows or the user flows so that you as a team get clarity on what are you really building, and the VCs get clarity. Slides cannot tell the story that UI can tell. So we'll have like 5 screens and it says, this screen is going to do this, this screen is going to do this, this screen is going to do this. And the amount of clarity that it brought to all the VC conversations was amazing. And it brought clarity to our conversations. Because when you say we're going to use Slack-like workflow, what does that mean? It's a chat room. No. It's the commands, where the outputs will go. So the debates become real when you actually have this. So what we had was like some sort of UX screens. We never used any of that code. It was all thrown away, but it brought clarity to the discussions.
You know, startups are all about decision-making, making the best out of scant resources. And I know you did marketing and sales and you've got your hands on everything. And one of the things that our listeners are suckers for is decision-making framework. And it's a pretty loaded question. So I'd love for you to go in any direction you'd like. So maybe let's start with product building. Were there like any decision-making frameworks that you used that people can find valuable and repeatable in any one area in your journey?
I think in the early days, we did use the business model canvas. It's not really a decision-making framework, but to me, that is an amazing, amazing tool to communicate when you have 3 or 4 people sitting around a table discussing merits of an idea or what part of idea is complete or not. We were all exposed to the business model canvas. Slavik, me, Dan, Guy, all sat down. We filled in all of the blocks. Like, if I remember correctly, it's got 8 different blocks across. So that's one thing we used.
For our listeners, maybe you can give us a quick one-on-one on the business model canvas. Is it like one of those things where every major decision, there are some trade-offs and you just write it down? Like, how does it work at a high level?
So business model canvas is not about a decision-making framework. What it's defining is, if you are working on an idea, in that idea, or in that business model, what are different aspects? So for example, and there's the things it has is, who are your key partners? If you're building something, who are your key partners? What are the key activities you need to do in that business? What are your key resources? What is your value prop? What are your customer relationships going to look like? What are your channels? What are your customer segments? What are your revenue streams? What is your cost structure? Now, very simple, but the idea here is, if you follow this model, what it really forced us to do was answer a lot of the questions which people ask. What is your business mode? What is going to be the barrier to entry? What will cost us the most? What will be our go-to-market strategy? Now, these are all questions you answer, but literally in this one sheet, if you start to fill this out, it answers everything about your business. By the way, it can be applied to non-software businesses as well. And so it's a very well-rounded framework from that perspective. I only know that we used it in the beginning. We did not continue to use it. I think most of our decisions were, make the decisions fast, execute, but measure continuously. And if it didn't work out, change them. Call it fail fast, as people call it, or move fast, break things, whatever Facebook calls it. I think that's the philosophy we went with most of the decisions on the non-product side. On the product side, we had this amazingly healthy balance. I don't think there was a framework, but again, personalities, we have one of us is way more conservative in thinking. One of us is way out there on the edge. So it balances that discussion out very well. When you propose a wild idea, the other person will say, no. But this has never been done. This has failed 3 times.
Really interesting insights right there. On the business model canvas, like, is the recommendation typically for major decisions, you know, obviously as you're entering the market or if you're pivoting or if you're trying to build a new sets of capability, you kind of put it up on the board so that everybody's looking at the thing, not for every micro decision.
So I would say if you're starting a new company, business model canvas is something worth exercising because it's summarizing your go-to-market strategy, who's your partner structure, what is your going to be biggest cost? Like, is software development the biggest cost? Yes, but no. The cost structure in a business, like if you, unless you sit down and answer that question, your sales is your highest cost structure in a software startup. Nobody would answer that early in their life cycle unless you really sit down. And then that affects how your channel is. So do that exercise. You're launching a new product, you're launching a new company. And once you start to answer that, I remember this yielded to so many big outcomes. I would say our channel strategy, which we heavily focused on go-to-market, was a byproduct of looking at this. We knew the sales is going to be expensive. How can I use channel there?
Yeah. And on the second aspect of fail fast, Jeff Bezos has this one-way door and two-way door decision making. One-way door, you make it once and, you know, you can't retract from that. Two-way door, you can do it. So in the fail fast sort of model even, did you have to make some decisions where you were at a juncture where you know this was a one-way door, outside of obviously picking security orchestration as the bet that you were going to make in the journey? Did you have to make a lot of one-way door type decisions?
Yeah. So they were one-way door and there were a lot of two-way door decisions. So Slavik, I'll quote him, in a lot of hires, we made the decision saying it's a two-way door. It's very interesting, right? It's like, every time I was torn on a hire, he would ask the same question. This hire looks like a two-way door. So why are you deliberating? It's like, okay, let's think about it like that. And that helps you get over that too much, I call analysis paralysis. If you actually call out a two-way door, then call out a two-way door. And then that was the two-way doors. Now, one-way doors, yes, there were certain product positioning. I think product positioning and feature decisions are almost one-way doors in the early stages. And I say almost one-way doors because a reset to those is a pivot which costs money and it costs time. Now, you could be a company where you can go raise money and pivot and there are enough success stories there. Okay, I'm not going to challenge. For Demisto, it happened to be that if I take my VC pitch from July of 15 or August of 15, that is still 80% of our sales pitch. Which basically for us, we made all of our one-way decisions very early in the life cycle. I would say there was the last one-way decision we made was April or May of 2017. And after that, the next 2-3 years have been pretty much on that. And the big one-way decision was declaring Phantom as one of our competition internally. We are basically now saying a pretty hot startup who is doing very, very, very well, we're going to go take them head on and actually build something in automation and try to outdo them. They started solid team. I respect every aspect of that competition. And we said, we're going to do that. And we did that.
I want to now pivot a little bit back to what, you know, how marketing was done at Demisto. And this kind of goes back to the business model aspects of it that we discussed earlier. Generally in B2B selling, especially in security space, the buying decisions are centralized. But at Demisto, you took bottoms-up approach where you kind of reached out directly to the users of the product. We see this happening a lot now in the industry, you know, Slack, Atlassian, even the DevSecOps startups. But what was the thinking back then? Because I'm sure there were some trade-offs that were done.
I think I would like to say it's like it was my brilliant idea to do this, but I think it happened somewhat serendipitously. I'll give you the journey. So the interesting thing is this was first scenario where we said, okay, we said, okay, Rishi is going to do marketing. I said, fantastic, let's go do marketing. The product was not even ready. Early started, like when we got our funding in September of 2015, it's like, okay, what do we do in marketing? I mean, we should do some marketing. What do you do in marketing when you don't even have the product clearly defined? No alpha, no beta. And I think at that point of time, the act that we did, which was super interesting, was like, okay, let's at least try to identify who our users are, and it'll do two things for us. One, that can give us early on interviews with those, because Dan, who ran products for us, was like, okay, I need to talk to people. Our UX expert says, I need to interview people. It's like, okay, how do we find these people who are going to be our users? So what we did was very simple. And from a marketing perspective, I says, I need to find out, where do our users hang out? Do they hang out on Twitter? Do they hang out in news groups somewhere of some sort? Do they meet in fire chats? So that's how the marketing started, right? I created a list of influencers in incident response space. Who's the person talking the most? What hashtags are being used on Twitter? Then how do I kind of attract these audience towards us? And then the second thing which to attract this audience, I says, why don't I create a list of all open source tools in incident response and put them on our website as just resources to learn their tutorials and stuff like that. And very quickly, what started to happen was we did those two things, which is I followed a lot of the influencers from the Demisto Twitter handle, and we put in these tools on our website. And suddenly I started to see we are bubbling up in search for incident response tool. People would search for Windows memory forensics tool. We would be the number one link for that tool, not nothing to do with Demisto. It was a resources page, but there were all the tutorials for that tool right there. And people would use that. People would send us a message like, hey, fantastic resource. What became clear to me is their users are looking for information that helps them to do their day-to-day job. And that's what we latched onto. If we provide the right set of information, people will become aware of Demisto. And it says, okay, let's start to do podcasts. Let's start to do fireside chats. We participated in some podcasts. We didn't even have a product. What do we learn about incident response? We invited somebody who has been doing incident response for years. Those were the motions that eventually made us realize that let's market to our users. And then when we launched our product, the first four customers that we got, or I would say first seven customers that we got, were customers we never knew of. These were people we never talked. They heard about us because they were on the community, Slack community that we had created to let people talk. And I was like, okay, this is working. If a startup who has no brand, no marketing spend out there, finds seven customers, we can go down that route. And that is when we started to say, we're going to do a free edition, run after that path, and let people find us rather than us go market to the execs there.
Now, this is a proven go-to-market model.
I think my learning was, in every aspect, right? You just see the results, you tweak. Whatever is working, do more of that. Whatever is not working, tweak it. And I think that's the iterative thing that we did there.
Yeah, the follow-up question was, if you're a founder, kind of like you've got binary choices on go-to-market, you go hire the enterprise sales team, go up, you know, do the whale hunting, or you go the Atlassian and Slack and Notion model, and Dropbox model. And the reality is, and I'm assuming that the truth is somewhere in the middle, because it's not like, hey, put up your website, have a credit card, do your demand gen the way you described, and they'll come, right? Because clearly their company, Slack, is getting crushed by Teams. Atlassian has been one of the few, I would say less than 10 SaaS success stories actually in this department. Otherwise, if you look at ServiceNow, Salesforce, Workday, it's big enterprise whale hunting. Where do you think the industry is today? Where is it going? Because, you know, if you're a startup, you can't do both. So if you got to pick one, like how do you decide?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, even with Demister, it was clear that it's not one or the other. It's somewhere in the middle. In fact, we made no sale at all without going top down as well. Okay. So when we say we went bottoms up,
yeah,
we use the bottoms up approach to get the user aware and trying our product and be a favorable person in the organization. To even close the deals, the first 7 deals, they absolutely involved a CISO meeting or a head of security operations meeting, because the answer is they're not going to put a credit card for $100K purchase on the website or $150K purchase on the website. So to answer your question specifically, which is how do you decide the go-to-market path? What I would advise is you don't say I'm going to go bottoms up or top down first and then follow that. You go back and say, okay, who's the user of my product? How much value does it deliver to an organization? It's going to deliver $2 million worth of value over 3 years, which means I can probably justify my pricing to be 300K as for 3 year pricing based on that ROI. 300K deal for 3 years is 100K a year. Nobody's going to just purchase 100K a year on the website right away. Or maybe they can if you start at a 5K and then grow it to 100K. So it's a function of product, the value delivered, your pricing model, all of the stuff you're going to put on your canvas. And that will drive your go-to-market motion. I've been talking to a lot of enterprise companies recently. They can use this mixed model. They always have to go top-down. They have to go to the CISO to sell $1 million deal. But still, reaching out to the users and spreading awareness with either a utility, with either just data for them, still benefits. And maybe that's your awareness model, where your sales model could be top down. So it could be all combinations of these things, but you make the decision based on overall strategy. And I think that is one important thing I want to highlight. In Demister journey, my realization was our alignment of the 4 founders across different aspects of product to engineering to marketing to sales made us win. It was never that product wanted to go create a downloadable tool and marketing was not behind it, right? I mean, if we said we're going to do a free edition, we marketed the heck out of the free edition. We created a business development reps motion behind that free edition where there was an SLA that if you get a free download, you've got to call that person in 45 minutes. And that was my SLA to sales. So that alignment went end to end. And without that, none of these things work.
Many security startups, to solve a specific problem, end up building features rather than thinking platforms. What is the secret sauce to think about products that solve for a category?
That's actually a tricky one, because I don't know if we went out and says we're going to do it as a platform. The biggest thing that we always wanted to make sure was you marry your product idea with a bigger trend in the industry. If you have bigger trends that's going on, which is for us was lots of security products that are being developed and they're not going to stop. Lots of attacks that are happening and they're not going to stop. And then we said, where is this bottleneck going to? Every time there was a new attack, there was a new product, new type of attack, new type of product. And that has been going on. If that is the bigger trend going on in the industry, can we build a product which solves that bigger trend? And the bigger the trend, the bigger your value prop will be and hence turns into a platform. That's one thing that we did. Second thing, which was also an incremental thinking, was we in early days quickly realized that there were certain adjacent markets that were emerging and we needed to force the merge of those markets. Specifically for us was case management or security ticketing or security incident response platforms, they were called SERP. There was a market emerging for that. And that was IBM Resilient, ServiceNow. There were 2-3 more in that space. And that was the case management market that was emerging, and then there was an automation orchestration market that was emerging. And our early decision was they are adjacent. We need to force the merge. We were the first company which says these are not two different things. This is the one thing. And then we pushed this to our customers. We pushed this to independent analysts from Gartner to Forrester that this is one thing. And we caused that market to merge rather than becoming two slivers of the market, which security industry does quite often. We have seen spyware to malware to every other minute market emerges and stays like that sliver of market. If companies think that merge this, force this, bring value across, like you cannot just put these two features in a product. You need to say, why is the value between case management and automation together and create an amazing experience there? And that's how you cause that merge.
Yeah, I can certainly hope that there are more founders like you who are thinking about this more holistically. In the security market, we have this disease where every little feature becomes a product in a company versus taking a holistic view. And that's one of the reasons why the industry is such a mess. I wanted to switch the gears on you a little bit and a couple more questions before we start with the fun rapid fire round. I know you work with, obviously, bulk of the Demisto teams are from Israel. So how was the experience working with teams in Israel, especially the engineering talent? But more broadly speaking, I'd love to get your perspective on sort of the future of remote hybrid work. You know, having teams in remote location is nothing new. Silicon Valley has started this like 20 years ago. Then 10 years ago, we said, well, is this less productivity? Let's get everybody in the headquarters. And then now everybody's like, no, go remote and hire in Vancouver and India and China and Israel and everywhere. What's your personal take on, if you're building a startup right now, where are you going to have teams? Like everywhere, couple location, how should we think about it?
I think it's a more of a function of the early team, the founding team. I would personally still pick two places or one place and not go fully distributed. And I think different people have different philosophy, by the way. There's nothing wrong one way or the other. It's the personal working style, personal decision-making. I still believe we miss a lot unless everybody literally gets in a room, whiteboards, argues for 2 days. Like most of our decisions on bigger product decisions, directions got made when either me or Slavik flew to Israel or the core team flew to US, sat in a room. And we used to do that somewhere between 3 to 4 times a year and spend a good week and make decisions. And then execution can happen distributed there, because I still believe the agree and commit or disagree and commit happens when you are looking the person in the eye. You can read a lot about it, the body language. People are nodding heads, but then they'll turn off the video and says like, I am out of here, right? I don't agree with this decision. In a room, you do not do that. If a person is sitting quiet in a room, you actually know this person is not committed to that idea, right? If it's a critical decision maker for that thing, if it's your head of engineering, not agree with the idea with the product person, you're going to go nowhere. So I would still pick your core set. Now, the question that you started with is like, how was the experience working with Israel? I think to me, it was amazing. There's a lot of talk of the culture. There is a lot of underpinnings which are very similar. People are not afraid to voice their opinions. People are not, both the cultures have talk loud, shout at each other thing. At the same time, Indian culture also has the aspect of, hey, I'm not going to disagree that much, but then you learn from the Israeli culture there. So I had a total blast. I did have hesitation going in, says, hey, total Israeli company, I'm the only founder, which is an outsider. Will that work? It worked beautifully. And then that was, again, goes back to the trust, goes back to the inclusion that the team had. But to me, the remote work works very well for certain teams. And I heard an amazing recent, the Zoom meeting or whatever it was from Zapier, which is a completely remote company. I had no idea. 100% remote. There's many other. GitLab is another one. I have a friend working there. They have done fantastic. And if you start the company with that mindset, if you define your decision-making frameworks that way, like for us, the decision needed to be made when we meet. If the decision gets made on Slack, that's fine. And those companies work fine. So I think for me, I would still pick one place and get started there.
So I think just to sum up kind of what you said was basically, you know, obviously making sure that having leadership and the core team in a central location improves the decision making. There's no replacement for that. But then once you set the tone and the direction, then you can have the execution remotely in one location or multiple of those. It doesn't really matter. And I think that seems like a pretty fine model.
Okay. And last question before the rapid fire. You worked in several startups. There aren't a lot of women starting security startups. Your one advice for women founders trying to start a company in B2B space specifically?
I think an advice for women thinking of starting startups is the biggest thing that you need to do when you're about to start is believe in yourself, right? I mean, you're going to make mistakes, but I think the fact that all of us question ourselves, look back at our each decision and analyze, gets us all in that state where we are not able to make that leap of faith. One, I always start by telling everybody I mentor is like, believe in yourself. Imagine you are the one who can create a Microsoft or an Apple or a whatever your trust started. And I think that's even a harder thing to do, I would say, for women founders, because they see all around. And as you said, there is not enough. And I think that drives that lack of belief that they can do it. So I think my number one advice is like, guys, you could be that one person who builds the Microsoft or the Apple or the whatever the next tech company is. So one, enforce that belief in yourself. And then two is have an amazingly open mindset. And I think that again for women is as we talk of more and more inclusion, I would claim that there's enough men who do not have that bias, who do not have that thing going against them. So as you get on with the journey, keep an open mind. Of course, still watch for the biases and how you're being not treated fairly. But at the same time, go with a very open mind that there's a lot of people helping. I am a big believer there is more good than evil in the world. And that same thing applies here. And the third part is do not hesitate to reach out for help. I think this one also ties into the inherent characteristics. I cannot tell you the power of cold calling or cold emailing or LinkedIn mails when you're starting on a new journey. Do not worry about who you are, what's your background, reach out, ask for help. And we did that a lot in the early days. Is this person going to respond to me? I reached out to CIOs of Amex, of US Bank. We did. And we got 5% response. Guess what? That's 5% more than what you would have got if you did not reach out. So those are the few things I would tell.
Awesome. Yeah, that brings us to the last segment. Yeah, so yes or no, or you are welcome to elaborate on any of these things, but we'll start with our first one. What's your favorite gadget nowadays?
Oh, my favorite gadget is Arduino. Call it a chip, but I'm playing with a lot of Arduino stuff.
What's that?
Arduino is the microcontroller, and I'm building very small projects. I've never done microcontroller programming. I've been playing, trying to control some of my pool equipment with that, controlling and making a candy dispenser for Halloween, a touchless candy dispenser and stuff like that.
Wow, we need to have you. Well, actually, you should avoid my house at all costs because my wife is going to get mad at me as to how useless I am. Who's been your biggest inspiration in tech industry?
This one is an interesting one. I think somewhere between Steve Jobs and Elon Musk for making those rad decisions without thinking through much, and Steve Jobs for the product sense and insight. And I think sometimes you need to make those rad decisions, but also have the product inside. So somewhere between those two people.
Got it. For somebody who wants to really grow their career, become an entrepreneur, in your mind, is work-life balance a myth?
No, I actually think this one I will elaborate, Ankur. I think work-life balance is not a myth, but work-life balance is something that person wants. Okay, I have some people who are not even in a startup, but their work-life balance means 16 hours a day of working. And different people have different definition of that. And I would encourage you to yourself go figure out what is your definition, what do you enjoy? For me, work-life balance, for example, was 16 hours of work, but 3 hours of dead time at 6 to 9 p.m. in the evening. And same was with pretty much Slavik, our co-founder as well. 5 p.m., everybody used to leave from Demisto, like, is this even a startup? It's like, why are everybody leaving? There were some people who stayed back. But hey, 5 to 9 p.m., 5 to 8 p.m. was dead time, family time. So I would not say it's a myth, but it's what you define it to be. Your health, your well-being is super critical. For me, sleep was the most thing. So in the entire startup journey, I still had my 7 hours of sleep every freaking night throughout the startup journey.
Amazing. Thank you for that perspective. I think a lot of entrepreneurs will get really encouraged to hear that. All right. One advice you'd give your younger 18-year-old self?
That's a good one. I would say read more, which I still don't do enough of, but read more increases your perspectives, how you think about it, things, different things.
Great. Who should we invite next in the pod?
I think you should get non-security folks who are doing startups, which are inspired from B2C world, but trying to go in enterprise. I think there's a lot more innovation to be done in enterprise. Would you like me to put a name there, Rankar?
I'd love it.
I would love to have you guys invite Lee Honeywell, who I've known her, and she was at Slack running their incident response program. That was our first fireside chat and guest. She's fantastic. She has got some good product ideas and an amazing speaker.
Love it. Thank you for that, Rishi. And the last question, which area of technology is your next startup going to be in?
I think it's going to be enterprise for sure, Ankur. I don't know if it is going to be, let me put it this way. I think which space will my next product going to be in? Because I think the startups to me, and even at McAfee, we did a whole bunch of products, is going to be an enterprise. Is going to be related to SaaS and cloud because a lot to be done there. Also, it's going to be driving efficiency for the workforce. I still think there is so many processes in our workforce, whether it's security or whether it's general IT, that people are wasting time at. Having done the Demisto journey, I think we have not brought the efficiency. And the efficiencies could range from your badging check-in systems to your video security systems, to your IT operations, your finance. A lot of inefficiencies exist, and I hate inefficiencies. That's one thing about me, I think. So one thing I can tell you is it's going to be something that makes life easier for people.
Great answer. But our listeners want more red meat. So maybe you can tell us your second best idea, and you can keep your first one.
I would actually go challenge founders to go pick up the entire finance processing space within enterprises, how the entire billings and finance and all of those systems happen and drive efficiencies there. I can tell you there have been startups on pricing automation and stuff on the SaaS world, but I have not seen the entire financial efficiency and how that works, including taxation. It's horrible. Like TurboTax has changed our personal lives.
Yeah,
I can tell you, the finance people, they still live 40 years back when it comes to processes and stuff in financial systems on the enterprise side.
Yeah. Spoken like somebody who must have been jerked around by the finance team one too many times.
And awesome. Having lived that even within Demisto when we were handling our own finance. Still live in Excel spreadsheets. Horrible.
Awesome. Well, Rishi, you've been really generous with your time. We really appreciate you coming on the pod, and we hope to have you once again, maybe a year from now, you know, whilst you're still at Palo Alto or, you know, doing your own thing. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. I'm very, very thrilled, Ankur and Nilima. This was really fun. I think that was more fun. That's why I didn't even realize how much time has passed. So thank you for having me here, and definitely will be happy to come back again.